May 11th is Mother's Day, and so it's fast approaching. If you haven't figured out what to get your mom, I do have a suggestion. This was given to Heather a couple of years ago, and the book is called There Are Moms Way Worse Than You. Now, I do have to admit, I got to be very careful, because if you do get this book and start reading it, I'm prepping you. There is some foul language in here. I'm like reading it, like, oh, this is really kind of cute, but like, oh my, that got dark really fast. I love the tagline. It's irrefutable proof that you are indeed a fantastic parent. So, and it goes through the animal kingdom, and it talks about, you know, what animal moms do, and some of the things that animal moms do are pretty darn terrible. And yes, there is a companion volume called There Are Dads Way Worse Than You. And on the cover of that is a picture of Luke Skywalker with his arm chopped off by his own father. So there are dads way worse than you, and there are moms. This is to help you feel a little bit better. But again, yes, if you go buy this for your parents, like, prep them ahead of time. Like, mom, just letting you know, there might be some words in there that might not be the best. But if you want to read it, it's really funny. This is probably about the only funny thing that I'm ever going to be able to share with you in this particular chapter, because we are going to hit some sections here in chapter 4 where we are going to read about moms that are pretty terrible. Definitely can't preach this on a Mother's Day, Lamentations 4, terrible Mother's Day text. Yeah, so next time, you know what you should do? Maybe write out a card, like, Happy Mother's Day, and put Lamentations 4, and see if your mom will read it. That might be, and then if she goes, thank you for that scripture passage, you know she's a liar and didn't actually read the thing. So in this, we once again have to sit with grief, and we have to understand some of the pain, that the voice has changed once again. And now it is this person that is reflecting back on all the stuff that's happened, because that's what grief often does to us. We experience something difficult and painful, and then our mind goes back and goes over that several times. And we wonder if there's ever going to be some kind of end to this. And then, again, we might be feeling this pain that, like, God hates me, God's wrath is upon me, I don't know how I'm going to handle this. And probably one of the biggest questions on your mind is, will it ever end? Will I ever get back to some level of normal? And anyone who's gone through massive amounts of grief will know that there is no such thing as going back to normal again. You learn how to adapt, you learn how to live with the pain, and then it's just kind of how it is for you for the rest of your life. Some people have likened it to maybe someone losing a limb. Right? Maybe there comes a point when the pain can finally subside, but you're walking around incomplete. Something's wrong. Something isn't right, because I have to figure out how to live my life under this new normal. And that's what the lamenter is now doing. You'll see with chapter 4, verse 1, he once again breaks it up, and I'll be breaking it up in the kind of the same pattern. He likes to do 10 verses, 10 verses, 2 verses. And again, he is following, if you see the text note on the number 4, that this is an acrostic poem, so it's starting with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and each subsequent verse goes on it. So we know that it's not designed to be some sort of a chronicle. It's not a narrative per se, because it's poetic. It really is this poetry that is pretty amazing to think about. So he's going to start and talking about how things in his life are just simply different. And he's going to be mourning the things that he's lost. How the gold has lost its luster. The fine gold become dull. The sacred gems are scattered at the head of every street. How the precious sons of Zion, once worth their weight in gold, are now considered as pots of clay, the work of a potter's hand. Even jackals offer their breasts to nurse their young, but my people have become heartless like ostriches in the desert. Here's this, there are moms way worse than you section. Because of thirst, the infant's tongue sticks to the roof of its mouth. The children beg for bread, but no one gives it to them. Those who once ate delicacies are destitute in the streets. Those nurtured in purple now lie on a ash heap. The punishment of my people is greater than that of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment without a hand turned to help her. The princes were brighter than snow and whiter than milk, their bodies more ruddy than rubies, their appearance like sapphires, but now they are blacker than soot. They are not recognized in the streets. Their skin has shriveled on their bones. It has become as dry as a stick. Those killed by the sword are better off than those who die of famine. Racked with hunger, they waste away for lack of food from the field. With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own children who became their food when my people were destroyed. So this first section, once again, this idea that the gold has lost its luster, it's really interesting because yeah, you end up going down some rabbit trails. I'm no gemologist, a geologist, what's gold? A metallurgist? I'm not a metallurgist. And can gold lose its luster? Can gold rot? Can gold rust? No, it can't. It's interesting, but this is, the lamenter is talking about this could never happen. The idea that Jerusalem could fall, the idea that God was turning his back on his people, the fact that there was such sin going on, that God had to mete out punishment, it was something that could have never happened. And so he's like, gold lost its luster. It's now dirty. It's now gross. Things are totally different than anything that I could have ever even thought of. And then he talks about how even the jackals offer their breasts in milk to feed their young. Yet the people didn't. There was this idea with the siege. In those days, you would surround a city, not letting water, food, anything go in or out. And what ended up happening was moms that were nursing their young realized that the caloric expenditure was so high, it would be better to just let the kid die than to feed them. And the infant's tongue sticks to the roof of their mouth. This is how bad it's getting. And then it goes on about the interesting thing when he says, the punishment of my people is greater than that of Sodom. And you could kind of understand that a little bit. How is that possible? Well, Sodom, when they got lit up, how quickly did they die? In an instant. They probably also didn't even see it coming. They were just there doing their thing, and God brought his punishment down, and they were gone in an instant. How much harder it is to die a slow, methodical, painful death. A death that was praised by the captors, praised by those sieging, the people who were always attacking. And so he's talking about how these people, these princes that once were whiter than milk and ruddy, and they were the leadership, and the leadership had all of the money and all of the power and all of the fame, and now it doesn't matter because once the siege hits, it doesn't matter what power you have. You now are literally nothing. And now their skin being blacker than dirt and drier than leather and a stick. And how, again, it even pictures a little bit of this idea of a march. When you would get captured back in those days, obviously you're not going to be flown on a plane. You're not going to be shipped on a train. You're not going to be put onto a ship. You would literally walk, oftentimes naked, through every other land to parade your loss so that the world could see how weak you are. And then, of course, ending with this idea of women cooking their own children. Suffering changes you. When you go through something super painful, you can't go back to the way it was. Food just doesn't taste quite the same. Music doesn't quite hit the same. Reading the books doesn't quite hit the same. And that suffering has caused you to become dry and dusty. And you look around this world and you see its cruelty. Like you, I am one who every time, and I'm sorry, I have to do it for my own sanity. Every single time the SPCA puts out a commercial and you see the dogs and they're tied up and they're either sitting in cold or overheating, and you just think to yourself, this world is cruel. Do you ever even just stop to imagine it? It's kind of hard to do that, isn't it? It's not fun. This world is cruel, filled with such cruelty that people didn't mind that when they did sieges that women would actually eat their own children. They're like, well, that's just the price of war. The lamenter is sad because this world is filled with hate and cruelty. But wait, there's more. It gets worse. I was going to say it gets better. No, it gets worse. Because where the worst possible cruelty can come from is in the church. And the lamenter then goes on and he starts talking about how God essentially lays the blame now no longer at the foot of the people. Yes, there is blame to go around. Yes, the people followed after what the prophets and the priests said. Yes, they didn't have the ability to step up and say something. Again, it's that psychological challenge. Again, looking at any sort of cult, you see that the inability to push back against this authority saying, I think that is wrong, causes people to just follow along even when the church itself messes up. And God is angry about this. Verse 11. The Lord has given full vent to his wrath. He has poured out his fierce anger. He kindled a fire in Zion that consumed her boundaries. The kings of the earth did not believe, nor did any of the world's people, that enemies and foes could enter the gates of Jerusalem. But it happened because of the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests, who shed within her the blood of the righteous. This idea of the prophets and the priests being responsible is really important. If you'd been with me for a while, you'll remember back to probably, I would say, Lamentations has been a challenging book. I'd say the second most challenging book that I've ever had to preach through is the book of Ezekiel. And Ezekiel is in this same vein. Ezekiel is one of the prophets that was right there during the fall. And I want to read to you, and you can turn there if you're fast enough with me. You can keep your hand in Lamentations 4, but if you could turn to Ezekiel. It's the next book over, Ezekiel chapter 8. You're just going forward. Some strange stuff happens in Ezekiel. I mean, it not only has some really weird descriptions about angels. I think, what was it, last? Yeah, for Christmas I tried to make accurate angel depictions of with cookies. And it was really easy because all I did was, like, you can go and buy, like, those things that just have a bunch of eyes. And I just did, like, these weird-shaped cookies, and I just stuffed eyeballs in it. And my nephews and nieces loved it. I thought that was pretty good. So Ezekiel has all of that stuff. It has dry bones. Ezekiel 8 has this really weird thing where Ezekiel is prophesying against now the priests, and God has to show him the evil within the church. Does this sound like fun? Ezekiel 8, in the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day, while I was sitting in my house, and the elders of Judah were sitting before me, the hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me there. I looked and I saw a figure like that of a man from what appeared to be his waist down. He was like fire, and from there up, his appearance was as bright as glowing metal. Okay, I'm freaking out a little bit already. He stretched out what looked like a hand. Okay, yeah, I don't like any of this. And took me by the hair of my head. Oh, this is really fun. The Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and in visions of God, he took me to Jerusalem, to the entrance, to the north gate of the inner court, where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood, and there before me was the glory of God of Israel in the vision I had seen in the plain. Then he said to me, Son of man, look toward the north. So I looked, and in the entrance, north of the gate of the altar, I saw the idol of jealousy. And he said, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? He's showing, I'm like, what are the priests actually doing, right? I know it's mystery, right? Like, I only work on Sundays. You know, I know that. Like, what does Mark Manning do all week? Well, Mark Manning does not do Ezekiel 8, so I can guarantee you that. I have some people that can vouch for me on that, but this was what was happening, especially because the priests and the prophets were almost untouchable, right? There was a time in a period of time when that was even here, when you couldn't question a priest, when you couldn't go against an authority. Now you guys are way too comfortable going against authority. So you all need to like shape up a little bit more, and that'll be great. No, I want you to constantly be pushing back on me. Like, hey, are you sure? Is that right? Think about that. And this is what, so then he brought me to the entrance of the, verse 7. Then he, verse 6. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they're doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here, things that will drive me far from my sanctuary, but you will see things that are even more detestable. Then he brought me to the entrance to the court. I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. He said to me, Son of man, now dig into the wall. So I dug into the wall and saw a doorway there. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked and detestable things they are doing here. So I went in and looked, and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. In front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel. And Jazaniah, son of Shaphan, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. He said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness, each at the shrine of his own idol? They say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. Again, he said, you will see them doing things that are even more detestable. And it goes on to talk about how these elders, these priests, these prophets had finally gotten into such heinous sin, they just simply said, no one sees this and no one can stop us. And it turns out to be just more stories in the long line of religious abuses. The two sons of Eli, Phinehas and Hophni, also evil people, having all sorts of sexual misconduct. They also were putting their hand in the till, so to speak, as they stole food, putting stuff in and taking out the best choice parts. Not only that, taking the parts that were reserved for God himself and saying, I'm going to eat this, and I can do whatever I want because my dad is the priest, and he is weak and won't stop us. I think all of us know of scandals that have plagued the church throughout the years. Obviously, the Catholic sex abuse scandal, where priests were no longer punished, but just simply shifted. Okay, this is bad. This looks bad for the church. We don't want the church to get a black eye, so you know what we're going to do? Let's just shift this guy and put him somewhere else. And how many people have been hurt by the church in the name of Jesus Christ? I got really angry this week because I ended up just, honestly, I wasn't searching for material, and then God had two people talk to me about how they had been hurt at the hands of a church. Got angry. Like, why? And it's hard because the church is supposed to be a place where you go to receive grace and mercy, to receive protection, to receive instruction in Jesus Christ, to understand the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love of God. We're supposed to be getting that, but so many people at the hands of the church are getting hurt and damaged beyond repair sometimes. It's angering because I also am a pastor, and I know that that makes it very difficult for me sometimes. You know, I'll never forget one time me and another pastor from another church that was renting here, we were going to meet a young lady, and I remember I walked in through right here, and the young lady was sitting over there, and I walked in, and immediately she flinched. And I was like, I'm going to stay over here, because something is wrong, and I don't want her to feel like it's just her and I in this room. And thankfully, the other pastor then showed up, and we were able to talk. But I also remember a time when I was in doctoral classes, and we were talking about elevators, and a woman said, guys, when the elevator doors open, what do you do? And all of us guys are like, we get in the elevator. Right? And that's an easy answer. Do you want to know what women do? Scan the elevator, step back, can I get in? The damage that I think that is done in the name of Jesus has got to be, in my estimation, some of the most heinous stuff that could ever be talked about. And that's what God sometimes then has to destroy and take down even seemingly successful churches so that he can clean that house. I do believe that is one of the reasons why, if you ever watched Mark Driscoll with The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, it's a fascinating podcast. Listen to the whole thing, and it was all because Mark Driscoll was a very angry, very domineering, greedy kind of guy. I mean, to the point where Mark Driscoll and his team from his church was heading off to do some mission work. And so they're driving to where they're going to be staying. And, you know, they pull up to where they're staying. And it's, you know, they're in a foreign country. It's not that good. It's not that pretty. It's a little gross. It's in a little bit of a sketchier neighborhood. And so the staff says, but hey, we're here to minister. We're here to love. Let's do this. So they go out. They all start climbing out. And guess who does not get out of the van? Mark Driscoll. And they're like, where are you going? He goes, oh, I ain't staying here. And he stayed at a very nice 5-star resort about 30 minutes away. People, there is evil in the church. And that's a hard thing to say because I'm in the church. But I also know that this is not surprising to God, right? Is Jesus shocked by some of these things? No, he's not. Jesus himself tells a story about it. And we often don't think about it because, again, it's a terrible thought to think. It talks about how a man is going out and he's planting all his seeds, and all of a sudden his wheat starts growing up, and this is really great, but he has a neighbor who's really kind of mean and vindictive, kind of like Irene. And no, I'm just kidding. We love Irene. Are you kidding? Happy birthday, Irene. Yeah, you made it into the sermon, too. Isn't that great? So, mean, vindictive neighbor who comes, and guess what that person does? They sow weeds. And then the people are like, well, what do we do? And they're like, we just have to let this grow up, because if we pull that out, we're going to damage everyone else. Yet we also know that that kind of damage is just horrific. I'm sorry that there's cruelty in the church. It is some of the worst stuff that's out there. I wish it didn't exist. But in the church, that's where people think that people can be easy targets. What they will call me, what I'm labeled in Scripture, is I'm what's called the under-shepherd. And so Jesus is our good shepherd, and I'm the under-shepherd. And My job is to protect the flock, and I will destroy anything that dares come against it. And the worst thing that could ever happen is if I ever turn on the flock and become the damager in chief. If you have been hurt by the church, I can only apologize. I wish I could take it away. I wish it never happened. But I know that there's evil in the church, and it's going to keep growing. It's just the way it is, which is why what's important for us? What are we supposed to be doing? How should we be living? How should we be caring for someone? I mean, this is the reason why I think it is so important that you've got to be super careful with people that are walking in the church. You have no idea what they're going through. They might be struggling with some of the greatest things that you've never even imagined, and they're hurting, and you're concerned about if someone's sitting in your chair. Get out of my spot. Well, yeah, someone's hurting and struggling, and we're worried about our seat assignments. The church is not a place for evil. It's not a good thing. It never should be allowed. And as I know, it's still going to happen. I've told stories of churches, even my own church, and some of the evil that it did. It's going to happen. And all I can say is let's just continue to be humble and get close to God. And then pray for those people who have been hurt. Because it's something that never goes away. And for those that have been hurt by the church and can continue to come to the church, I think that's the most amazing thing possible, because that is the strongest thing that you could ever do. And to maybe and hopefully and prayerfully not connect the pain of the church as if it is God doing it to you. So, the evil of, and again, if you ever see evil here, we call it out. If you ever leave for some reason, like you're going to go and visit other churches or be other places, I mean, the only thing that I can tell you is just please make sure that evil is not something that's tolerated or allowed. And then you've got to be very careful of those pastors, especially the ones that talk for 45 minutes. So they're probably covering for something. Are they pointing you to Jesus? Are they telling you of just how loved you are? And I just wish that I could help you know that more. Because we read these Old Testament passages, and this is the problem. Because God, we build up this, the thing that Heather is doing with the kids down there is amazing. She has them with a soda, right? And just imagine you shake that soda up, because this is the sins. This is the sins of the people. This is the sins of the pastors. This is the sins of the priests. And it's shaking and shaking and shaking. And all of a sudden there comes a point when God's like, I can't do it no more. And you open up that lid and God's wrath just pours out. And where does it hit? It kind of just hits everywhere. And it's this massive thing. And we talk about how God, the last couple of verses are these wonderful, sweet words where it says God's wrath is finally ending. And it points to a time, it's foreshadowing a time when God's wrath is not going to be poured out on us that way, because God's wrath is going to be poured out now specifically on one person. And that one person is Jesus, and he's doing it because he loves you so much. He loves me so much. And yeah, we are going to sing that song, Reckless Love, and I love it because some people are like, Jesus' love is not reckless. Jesus, you can't call Jesus reckless. Oh my gosh, Jesus is the most reckless lover of all times. He takes you and me, you nasty, horrible, sin-filled creature, and just pours out his love on you. You who are crying and weeping, he pours out his love on you. You who are stubborn and refusing to see sin, he's pouring out his love and grace to try to get you to see where you are at. And if there is anything else that you can get from any of these sermons, it's the intense, never-ending pursuit of God of you. When I've taught the Old Testament an overview thing, I think the Old Testament is the description of a God who is in a relentless pursuit of his people. And you see that from Genesis all the way through Malachi. And then you see the opening verses of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John pointing to how God manifests that and puts that into one person, Jesus Christ. And he says, I know that things have been difficult. I know that things have been hard. He goes to the woman caught in adultery and gives her love. He goes to the Pharisees and has harsh words to say. You see how God is now coming in and starting to protect and saying, I've got to clear some things out and I need to settle with sin. And God's wrath was then poured out immensely onto Jesus Christ, and his wrath was satisfied. So we keep on going. There is cruelty in the world and there is cruelty in the church, and sometimes that suffering will change you. And that is a hard thing to accept, especially when you have suffered at the hands of people that you didn't want to suffer. And yet, I think so many of us have. Verse 14, so it now talks about how these prophets and these priests and how they were not doing things right, and then now they grope through the streets like men who are blind. These people who could see everything, these people who could see God and speak for God, and they're like, well, they're blind people now. They don't even know what they're doing. They are so defiled with blood that no one dares to touch their garments. Go away, you are unclean, men cry to them. Away, away, don't touch us. When they flee and wander about, people among the nations say they can stay here no longer. I mean, talk about a backlash against prophets and priests, and in the early part, kings and princes. God will take care of that. The Lord himself has scattered them. He no longer watches over them. The priests are shown no honor. The elders, no favor. I love this. Isn't this great stuff? Like, pastor, no honor for you, no favor for you. And I get it. I accept it. I think sometimes we need to. Moreover, our eyes failed, looking in vain for help. From our towers we watched for a nation that could not save us. They're looking for hope. They're looking out, and it's really sad because they actually had some help that was supposed to be coming. Egypt was actually on its way. They had actually, you know, got onto Twitter and said, hey, we're being attacked, and Egypt was like tweeting back. No, you can't call it that anymore. Xing back, we're on our way. And sure enough, Egypt starts marching towards the land, and guess what the Babylonians do? They all start marching towards Egypt, and Egypt says, my bad, sorry, never mind, and turned around. So now they're looking out, who's going to save them? Who's going to help them? Who's going to be there for them? Verse 18, men stalked us at every step, so we could not walk in our streets. Our end was near, our days were numbered, for our end had come. Our pursuers were swifter than eagles in the sky. They chased us over mountains and lay in wait for us in the desert. The Lord's anointed, unfortunately not a reference to Jesus. I really wanted it to be because I thought that would be kind of cool. Because the Lord's anointed is the word Christ or Messiah. Thought that was kind of cool, but no. The Lord's anointed, our very life breath, was caught in their traps. We thought that under his shadow we would live among the nations. And you can read about what exactly happened. That's in 2 Kings chapter 25. It was a king, his name was Zedekiah. He was kind of the last hope of the kingdom. And these kings were often called the Lord's anointed. And so they were hoping that he was going to be their last-ditch effort. And then ultimately he got captured. And then they looked at him and said, the last thing you will see is the death of your two sons. And then they killed his two sons right there in front of him and then gouged out his eyes so he could see nothing else. So it seems like there's no hope now, right? There's nothing left. And that's why we need to keep pointing to the true Lord's anointed, who was whipped and beaten, who was mocked mercilessly. And out of curiosity, what entity was the one responsible for so much of his pain and suffering? The religious people, the church, in their quest for power to say, I know what's right, I will hurt, I will kill, I will destroy. So when you might feel that pain of suffering at the hands of churches, Jesus knows exactly what you're feeling. Not only that, he decided to go through it full force for you. He decided to do that because of his intense love for you. And he never wants you to think that you are ever, ever alone. He is with you. So it makes it hard when we get to verse 21, but there's again this little bit of shift, a little bit of hope, a little bit of mercy, a little bit of grace that the lamenter is looking forward to. He knows that God is not a God who, once you shake up the can so much, it's not going to explode forever. Eventually it runs out. And that's what he says, "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom." Wait. "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom." Who are the Edomites again? Yeah, these are the descendants of Esau. So these were the people that were part of the Edomite area. It's in the southeast part. And the Edomites were supposed to be friends. And what did the Edomites do? Well, there was a big prophecy against them in that wonderful book called Obadiah that we just read not that long ago, and where they were part and parcel of the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Israelite nation. And this is what the person says, "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom." Oh, well, I can't wait to hear this. This is going to be juicy. "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, you who live in the land of Uz. But to you also the cup will be passed. You will be drunk and stripped naked. O daughter of Zion, your punishment will end. He will not prolong your exile. But O daughter of Edom, he will punish your sin and expose your wickedness." Those who would dare gloat over damage to people, those who would dare gloat, those people who would dare damage the church of God, anyone who would stand and be a prophet or a priest and hurt those people, rejoice and be glad, you people, because the cup of God's wrath is going to be given to you, and you will drink it to the dregs. Now, it doesn't happen as quick as we want, right? I would personally love, you've heard me say this, I personally would love lightning strikes. I think that would be fun. Even if it's just like small little zaps, I think that'd be neat. I think it would be very disruptive to church, right? Because all of a sudden someone's like, "Ah!" It'd be like, oh, what are we doing back there? Oh, thinking bad thoughts, are we? Zap, oh, you think the sermon's going too long. God will strike you for that one. Zap, I get hit because God's like, "Shut up, you don't know what you're talking about." We always worry about justice, and it's hard to wait. And even in the book of Revelation, the martyrs are under the altar, and they're crying out, "I want justice," and it never comes the way we want it to, do we? Never comes as quickly as we want, as swiftly as we want, or as complete as we want. But you don't have to worry about that, because God sees and knows everything. He sees those evil priests that are doing the temple worship. He sees those evil people who are doing damage to his people. He sees all of that, and he will, in fact, at some point pour out his wrath. And that will be a wrath that will not end. But for those who trust in the mercy of Jesus Christ, those who understand his love and receive his love, they no longer have to worry about wrath being poured out on them, because guess what? God poured all of his wrath onto Jesus so that you might be loved, cared for, given the forgiveness of sins and the promise of eternal life. So there's hope, even when things are bad, even when everything looks bleak, even when it looks like there's no help on its way. God says, "I am with you. I will walk with you. I have suffered as you have suffered. I have been hurt as you have been hurt. I weep with you. I mourn with you." And one day, we will be able to be ushered into a place that does not have pain and sorrow and hurt and misery. We will be ushered into a place of God's amazing and abundant love. And if you don't know that love, I pray that you know that today. And I pray that if you don't feel God's love, I pray that you might experience just maybe even a taste of it, knowing that he will pour out so much more on you. God is a God who can be trusted because of his great love. Let's pray.